Welcome to podcast number 181 of My Favorite Detective Stories. I'm your host, John A. Hoda, and today's date is October 4th, 2022. Our guest this week is Paula Meunier. Paula is a literary agent and the USA Today bestselling author of the Mercy Car Mysteries. A Borrowing of Bones, the first in the series, was nominated for the Mary Higgins Clark Award and named the Dogwise Book of the Year. Blind Search was inspired by the real-life rescue of a little boy with autism who got lost in the woods. The Hiding Place debuted in March of 2021. Her latest Mercy Car mystery, The Wedding Plot, released July 19, 2022, through Minotaur Books. Paula credits the hero dogs of Mission Canine Rescue, her own rescue dogs, and a deep love of New England as her series' major influences. Paula has also written three popular books on writing, Plot Perfect, The Writer's Guide to Beginnings, Writing with Quiet Hands, as well as Fixing Freddy and Happier Every Day. This is a fun interview, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. Welcome to My Favorite Detective Stories. I'm your host, John A. Hoda. Come sit by my campfire as we listen to crime fiction writers talking about their flawed fictional detectives. I will alternate weekly between award-winning and best-selling authors with debut authors who have overcome all the obstacles to get their first novel out into the world. This episode is brought to you by my own FBI agent Marcia O'Shea six-book series and my upcoming Gwendolyn Strong small-town cozy mystery series. To learn more, go to www.johnhoda.com, that's J-O-H-N-H-O-D-A.com, and join my email list. Liberty City Nights, my Marcia O'Shea prequel novella, is available to my subscribers there for free. Hi, Paula. Welcome to the show.
Well, hi. Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
Yeah, I know. It's a blast. I enjoy doing these all the time. Every week I get to talk to different writers about their flawed fictional detectives. And I don't know. I'm like a junkie with crack, I guess. It's for me. So how's the weather up there in New Hampshire today as we record this? April the 28th.
Well, the good news is the snow is melted. So yay. And it's sunny. And you can see the grass is green now and some of the daffodils are coming up, but it's cold and windy, so it's not quite spring yet, but we're getting there.
Okay. Interesting that you say that your daffodils are coming up. I know this is a podcast where we're going to talk about your work, but I'm presently writing a book called Milford Daffy Day, and it's about a daffodil festival in Milford. And well, the ubiquitous Milford. It's sort of like the Simpsons Springfield. It can be in anywhere USA. And so that you're telling me that your daffies are now just starting to come up, and here we are late April. My daffies come up towards mid-April, so I must be in a my ubiquitous Milford must be in a lower longitude. That's what I must be saying. But anyway.
Absolutely.
As we record this today, down here on the coast of southwestern Connecticut, it's we got like a polar wind screaming down out of the north, and it's just this bright sunshine, not a cloud in the sky, but it is freezing. So my little daffodils are saying, ouch, they're not happy about it today. Anyway, so I digress, as I normally do in the beginning. Paul, tell me about your writing journey. Tell me about how you got started. And we're not going to leave anything out. We're going to take our time and do it right.
Okie doke. Well, I was an army brat and an only child and went to a million different schools, right?
Sure.
And moved around a lot. And so I was alone a lot until I made new friends wherever it was we went. And so my dog and my books were my friends. And so I always loved books. And
Part
of me always wanted to be a writer.
And what was your dog's name?
My dog's name was Rogue. He was a miniature poodle and very, very smart.
Okay. The reason I say that is my little Billy is enjoying a bone at my feet this morning. I keep him kind of occupied during the podcast. So definitely. So Rogue and books. And I get it. No, I get it. There's solace to be taken from the ability to get into another world and do that for some period of time, especially when you're younger. That's the humble beginning. And when did you start dabbling with writing, and when did it become more serious for you?
Well, my ninth grade teacher called my mother and told her that I should be a writer. And I was 14. And when you're 14, you don't do anything your mother tells you to do. So I just ignored that. And I went off to college, where I studied geophysics of all things. And I decided that I needed to make extra money. So I would just write stories for my favorite magazines. And that was sort of the magazine heyday. And it was certainly the heyday of Cosmopolitan, the Helen Gurley Brown days. And that was my favorite magazine. So I sat down and I wrote a story and I sent it in, which of course is not the way it works. You can't just send in a story to Cosmopolitan. But somehow it got through the slush pile and it got published.
No kidding.
Yeah. So I thought, how hard is this, you know? And then I got married and had a couple kids, and eventually I found myself in my late 20s, divorced and broke with two kids to support. And I thought, okay, what can I do? I can't go off on an oil rig, which is where most of the geophysics jobs were at the time. So I'll just take these meager clips that I have and I'll talk my way into a job in publishing, which is what I did. And I got a job as an editorial assistant for a business magazine in Monterey, California. And then I just worked hard. I became a reporter and then an editor for magazines and newspapers. And eventually I got a job, my first book publishing job, as a managing editor for a book publisher out in California, which is now part of Penguin Random House. But at the time it was Independence. And I went to my first meeting and I thought, oh my goodness, they're going to pay me to talk about books. This is awesome. Because to me, being a writer meant writing books. Even though I was a reporter and had lots of articles, you know, to my credit, to me, that was really the thing as a writer, was to write books. And so I started writing my first books, mostly nonfiction.
Now, you must tell me, if you can, in 25 words or less, what is a geophysicist? Because I would fail miserably if that was a Jeopardy question.
It's literally the physics of the Earth. So, you know, how do the tectonic plates work in terms of physics? What does an earthquake mean in terms of physics? That kind of thing.
Okay. And that was 22 words. That was fantastic. That was great. No, I'm only kidding, but I don't know how many words, but that was a great explanation. I thank you very much. And if I ever get to do the Daily Double on Jeopardy, that I hope that's the answer. So
not all I remember. So I'm glad that was a question.
Yeah, no, that's good. I'm joking with you a little bit because, well, I know that as we went through what you were saying about going here, reporter this, and, you know, editor there, and then I get to be a, you know, book editor, and I'm saying, wait, my listeners might just want to say, back up a second, John, and ask her what a geophysicist is. So now you're in the nonfiction world, which we know is a lot different than the fiction world. Can you talk a little bit about what you were reviewing and what you were doing, and how did that grow into your writing career? How did you transform from that?
Well, certainly, you know, if you write nonfiction by day, whether it's a law brief or an article for a story or you know, a blog, whatever, you're playing the scales, right? You're playing the scales, you're playing with words. And I loved that. And so I did a lot of nonfiction as an acquisitions editor, but I also did some licensed fiction. And that was a lot of fun for me, and it taught me a new skill set. And I had to learn how to go from being a nonfiction writer and editor to a fiction writer. And the skills that serve you well in nonfiction do not serve you well as a novelist. So it was a transition period. It was a learning period for me, because I still, at my deep secret soul, wanted to be a mystery writer.
Really?
Yes, I always wanted to be a mystery writer. I loved mysteries since I was a kid.
And who were your earliest influences?
Well, I loved fairy tales. I loved Sherlock Holmes.
Yep.
I loved, you know, Nancy Drew and Encyclopedia Brown. And then, you know, back in those days, they didn't really have young adult fiction. There was just kids' books. There were kids' books and there were adult books. And so, you know, around 10 or so, I was a very avid reader. I started reading my mother's mysteries, which were always around the house. So Ellery Queen, Agatha Christie, Nero Wolfe, Perry Mason, all of those guys.
You know, when you first said that, My Mother's Mysteries. I said, oh, I've never heard that series before. So that's a hell of a reading list for your mom. I mean, Earl Stanley Gardner, A. Conan Doyle, Agatha Christie, you know, right?
Right.
Wow. And who else did you say? I'm sorry.
Well, Ellery Queen, Nero Wolfe, Perry Mason. I loved Perry Mason. You know, so yes, I read everything she had, you know, because those books weren't at the school library.
They were not?
No, they were at the post library. So I was there. Yeah. Okay. My mother was really great because, you know, all my peers read comic books. And we would go to the post commissary, right? And the PX, and they would have a little newsstand there. And I would always want a comic book because that's what the kids read.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother would never pay 25 cents for a comic book. She would say, you don't need a comic book. That's not good. I'll buy you a book. So for a dollar, I got a book. So I went through all the, you know, Nancy Drews and Hardy Boys and Cherry Ames and all those stories.
Cherry Ames. That's a new one for me. If you remember the character and the stories, please tell me a little bit more. If not, that's okay. We can move on.
No. I'm really dating myself here. But, you know, this was back in the, well, it must have been like the mid to late 60s. So Cherry Ames was a nurse. And, you know, back in those days, you were a nurse or a teacher if you worked outside the home, right?
Yes, that's true.
Right. So she was a nurse. And because she was a nurse, every book she got to be a different kind of nurse. So she'd be an army nurse in one book. She'd be, you know, an airline nurse in the next book. She'd be, you know, nursing home nurse in the next book. And then there was always a mystery that went with it. So she led what appeared to me to be a very independent life for a woman at that time. And I loved that.
Thank you for telling me that. I wouldn't have been a very good host if I just, oh yeah, Cherry Ames, sure. And not have a clue what you were talking about. No, I'm sorry. I have to kind of put the brakes on that once in a while and say, hey, wait a minute. What are you talking about? Who are you saying? That's new to me. Now I have a new person because, you know, I think of, like you just said, Encyclopedia Brown, Nancy Drew, now Cherry Ames. These were formative books that helped foment for you your love for mysteries, and they grabbed you on an emotional level as well as an intellectual, I take it, because as you were growing and getting older, you know, your reading went from the children's library at school to the post or to the, as you said, the post or to the real library. So that's cool. All right. So, these were the earlier influences in your mystery writing. When did you decide that you wanted to take a stab from doing writing in the nonfiction world into fiction?
Well, I always wrote. I wrote a novel in my, I don't know, I must have been my late 20s, early 30s. I finally finished a novel. And I got an agent, and it was a subgenre that died overnight. So by the time the book came out, you know, we never sold it because the subgenre died overnight. It was one of those sort of shopping and romance novels. And so it died, and it's just as well, I'm sure. But it got me an agent. And so that got me to thinking seriously about writing fiction.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, what happened was I got my first job as an acquisitions editor. And when you're an acquisitions editor, those are the people who acquire books for publishers.
Right. Now, is that fiction or nonfiction?
Both. I was doing both.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was doing both. I was doing lots of nonfiction, but also licensed fiction. So something like, you know, the Wonder Woman novel that Cherry James wrote. Is it Cherry James? Famous science fiction writer. Anyway, but people like that. So what was doing, we were doing licensed fictions because we were doing these strategy guides for video games. And in addition to doing the strategy guide, we'd also do the novelization of the game.
Wow.
Right. It was funny because, you know, these young kids who were writing the games, they all wanted to be novelists, but of course they had no experience writing fiction whatsoever. So that it was a challenge as an editor, but it taught me a lot. So it was great.
But they were storytellers in their games, though. So that's right. Interesting that they have a storytelling chops, but not necessarily the writing skills to translate it from one medium to the other. Did I understand that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely okay. Right. So that was my job and I loved it. But when you're an acquisitions editor, you are the midwife, right? You're not the writer. You're not the mother having the baby. You're the midwife. And that takes a lot of energy. And so it was hard for me to do that and write at the same time. So it really wasn't until later when my kids were grown and I wasn't an acquisitions editor anymore that I was able to really write a lot of fiction.
You know, and to your point, there are some employments that do not lend themselves to finding time to write or making time to write. I'm going to use the word making time to write. And being able to have, and I don't want to use a trotted out word, bandwidth, but not having the mental energy to be able to create after having such a mind-numbing day, but a mind-filling day. Is that a good way of putting it?
Yes. I mean, I think that we all have this creative impulse and it's there every day, but we can use it up or satisfy it by doing other creative things during the day. And so then we're not compelled to go to the empty page. So I think that was part of my problem. Also because, you know, I had teenagers and I just had all so much stuff going on. And what I really need is psychic space.
Yeah, no, I get it. And teenagers will rob you of that easily. I understand that. Now, I've had teenagers and and I'm not going to say anything bad about my kids. Love them. But you know, I tell you, I wouldn't have been able to sit down and write anything creative, you know, after being with them at the dinner table, honestly, just honestly. But anyhow, I digress. But you did find the time and you did create the psychic space to start writing. And I guess that's important. But there are people that do have very difficult jobs, such as lawyers, doctors. I've interviewed them on the podcast, police officers, DEA agents, people even undercover. And I say, how do you find the time or make the time to do it? And it wasn't so much making the time to do it, because there were times on airplanes sitting around court or waiting for things to happen or whatever, that they would find the time to do it. But it was to be able to turn one way of thinking off and turn another way on. And for them, it was almost like a refuge that they could go from one thing to the other. And so you hinted on that briefly in your description, and I understand it, but it seemed that acquisitions editing and for you, acquisition editing and teenagers did not allow you any other time to go into the creative well. That's how you were filled up at the time.
Yes, I think that's partly too. And I also think part of it's my own history as a reporter where, you know, give me a contract and a deadline and I will make it happen. Without that, you know, that is a lot harder for me. And so I think it was a combination of those things. You know, Hallie Efron told me, your problem is you never finish. So because for many years I started writing a lot of mysteries, but I didn't finish one. And she was absolutely right. I didn't finish because I would grow bored with my own story. So I think part of it is you have to find an idea that really can sustain your own interest for 400 pages.
Sure. And who did you quote just then?
Hallie Efron.
Tell me about Hallie. I'm sorry. I'm a little bit of a Luddite. So,
well, she's wonderful. She's one of the Efron sisters.
Oh, okay. I know Nora.
Yes. Okay. Well, there's Nora and Delia and Amy and Hallie, and they're all New York Times bestselling authors. That's quite a family. And she writes wonderful, wonderful thrillers. The last one I think was called Careful What You Wish For. And very good. She's a wonderful writer. And she's a dear mentor for me. And she always told me, you know, finish, you have to finish. So she's right. You have to finish, people.
Now, it tends to bring up a question for me because I am a plotter. And if some people would say that my writing was pedestrian, so I'd be a plotter. But no, I'm actually a plotter, so that I have my story pretty well thought out and pretty well creatively designed. And where the breakpoints are, midpoints, this point, that point, climax, denouement. And So I pretty much know my story, and I don't think I don't get bored at it, because if I've thought it all the way through, all the way beginning to end, well, I know there's a middle, a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it's just a matter of writing it as best as I can to get through, you know, the various stages of the novel. So when you said that you weren't a finisher, according to Ms. Efron, what was it? Are you a pantser, or was it that you just didn't like the idea to start with, and it just kept creeping up on you that, no, this is, doesn't really float my boat?
Well, I'll tell you two quick stories. So I wrote a book called Plot Perfect for Writer's Digest Books, and it's all about how to plot your novel. And I had always thought that plotting was my weakness, and so I was not cut out to be a mystery writer, because plotting is critical to good mystery. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote a book on plot, and I figured, okay, you wrote a book on plot, you should be able to plot a mystery. So I started thinking about what kind of idea would engage me and readers for 400 pages. And then I was asked to write another book on writing called The Writer's Guide to Beginnings. Because as an agent, you know, and an editor, it's the beginning of the novel where you say no and send it back. So it's very important for new writers to really nail their beginnings. And when I was writing this book, I knew I needed a first chapter that I could use as the basis of a lot of exercises, you know, to show editing, to show character development, to show all these things. And I couldn't do that with someone else's first chapter. So I thought, well, I'll just write one of my own. And I promise you there's a lesson here. So
no, go, please. I'm with you.
So I just had done this fundraiser for Mission Canine Rescue. And Mission Canine Rescue is an organization that takes military working dogs. Now, military working dogs, once they finish their service, if they're army dogs, they're usually well provided for, usually. But if they're defense contractor dogs, they often end up in kill shelters or in bad situations. Hmm. So I know it's terrible. So what Mission Canine Rescue does is they find these dogs and then they find them forever homes. And I met these dogs. And as you know, I'm a big dog lover. And I met them and their handlers, and I was just so impressed. I had just done this fundraiser. So I thought, oh, well, I'll write a first chapter of just this make-believe novel to use as an exercise for the Writer's Guide to Beginnings. And I'll throw in everything I love. I'll throw in Vermont, and I'll throw in a working dog, and I'll throw in a military MP who's home from Afghanistan. I'll throw in all these things that I love. And so I did. I wrote this opening chapter as an exercise for the Writer's Guide to Beginnings. And my agent said to me, that's great, finish that.
And you had done something for the sake of doing it, and with no idea that it would have a pinch point, a midpoint, a second pinch point, a climax, and an ending, right? You just had it written out as one chapter.
Right. It was the opening chapter. It was a good chapter. I will say that.
No, that's cool. I have written the first chapter as a writing exercise, and then it became the second chapter in my very first police procedural. I liked it so much, and it became a character that had legs through that book, and had a cameo in a couple of later ones. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
So that really works. And I think that the lesson there is that I threw in everything I loved, and I wasn't thinking about publishing. I was just thinking about doing this. And so by getting out of my own way, I was able to create a character and a situation that had legs.
Nice. And your agent said, yes.
My agent said, that sample chapter would make a great novel. You should write that novel.
And you did.
Because I always do what my agent tells me to do. Which we all should.
Yes. And you did.
Yes, I did.
And what was the name of that?
A Borrowing of Bones, the first book in the series.
Mm. And how many books was in the series altogether?
Number 4 came out in July. The Wedding Plot.
Excellent. Excellent. So now this is, and your protagonist, besides the dog, is
Mercy Carr. She's a veteran. She's home from Afghanistan. And she was wounded in the same battle that killed her fiance, who was a dog handler. And the last thing he said to her, knowing that his dog, Elvis, was a defense contractor dog and may face an uncertain future without him, said, "Take care of my dog." So she has to get the dog, come home to Vermont, and together they march off their grief and their survivor guilt in the wilderness of Vermont, where, of course, they come across a mystery to solve.
There you go. That's a hell of a hook. I like that a lot. I like that a lot. And the name of the first novel again, please, again for me, is?
A Borrowing of Bones.
Phones or bones?
Bones. A Borrowing of Bones. It's from a line from a Pablo Neruda poem called October. Life is only a borrowing of bones.
Gotcha. No, that's good. I mean, I'm sorry. And it wasn't your pronunciation. It was my hearing.
No.
No, seriously. No, I mean, you know, phones, bones. I'm even wearing headphones. so it was just difficult for me. So, wow. And the series continues in the saga of the defense contract service dog for Elvis.
Elvis, yes.
And Mercy?
Elvis and Mercy. And they team up with the local Vermont game warden, Troy Warner, and his search and rescue dog, Susie Bear, who's a Newfoundland retriever mix.
Okay. Now, in the spectrum of crime fiction genre, where does this kind of sit? Because you understand what I'm talking about.
Sure.
So where does it's
a traditional mystery.
Okay.
So it's not a cozy, and it's not noir. It's, you know, it's more, I tell you what I do. You know, I am an agent by day. And
okay.
So I have to sell books to publishers.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I can't sell a book unless I can shop it in 50 words or less.
Right.
And if I can differentiate it from the kind of book it's like. So what publishers always want is just like insert best-selling author here,
mm-hmm.
only different. And my job is to articulate that difference. And I knew my agent was going to ask me, okay. And so I said, you know what? I need to know who I want to be when I grow up as a writer. And I really wanted to be Julia Spencer Fleming, who writes wonderful novels, traditional mysteries, set in upstate New York, and his and her points of view. I love her. I love her work, like Ellie Griffith's Ruth Galloway series. I love them. And so I thought, I can't be Julia Spencer Fleming because there's already a Julia Spencer Fleming and she's fantastic. So, but I could be Julia Spencer Fleming with dogs.
Ah, I like that.
Yes.
And that's a great hook. That's like Gone Girl meets the XYZ, you know?
Exactly.
Fill in the blank. So you're Julia something Fleming?
Spencer
Fleming with dogs.
With dogs, yes. And I'm happy to say that when A Borrowing of Bones first came out, Library Journal reviewed it and they gave it a star. It was wonderful. And they said, you know, a lot of people will say this series is like Margaret Mitsushima or, you know, David Rosenfeld, but it really reminded me of Julia Spencer Fleming with dogs.
Ding, 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 ding. Dinner. Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
Exactly. So I did what I set out to do. And Julia Spencer Fleming has been a wonderful mentor to me and very supportive of the books. And even she will describe my books like that just now. So that's cool.
Mm. You know, and you just prompted me when you were saying that. I'm thinking about my cozies that are going to be coming out at the time of this, when we air this.
Cool.
And they will have been out for about 3 weeks when this airs. And I'm just thinking to myself, I have a great tagline already, which I'm not going to say right now. But I just thought, you know, just along the line of what you just said, having to pitch it from an agent to a book publisher in 50 words or less. And I thought to myself, if in about my cozy mystery amateur sleuth, if Sherlock Holmes married Miss Marple.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah. So you get the idea of the person that does the deduction, but also the person to understand that is a understands human nature like the back of your hand.
Yeah. Exactly. That's great.
Well, thank you. Thank you for helping me spitball that one, Paula. I appreciate that. That's going to be my next, when that comes across your Facebook feed as an ad, you're going to say, I remember when he thought that one up. So anyway, I enjoy it. So anyway, you've had a lot of fun with the series.
Absolutely. It's been a joy to write. You know, writing can be tough sometimes. And this last one was tough, but because my dad died and and he really loomed very large in my life. And so it was very hard. And I found myself unable to write because I was it was like swimming through molasses. All of life was like that. It wasn't just the writing. And I knew I had a deadline to meet and I knew I had to get moving. And so what I finally did was I just wrote the kernel into the book.
Damn.
And it was great. And I think somewhere he's smiling.
Damn. I know I'm saying damn, but in a, not in a damning way, but you know, in a way of damn, that's a great idea. Damn. That's what you needed to do. Wow. That makes so much sense because it lifted you out of the molasses. It lifted you out of the morass.
Right.
And it allowed you to speak with a deep voice, with genuine feeling. And as an homage to the Colonel,
absolutely. I was able to honor him.
Right. You were able to try to make the best words flow out of your head onto the page within the confines of the story arc of it being the fourth book in the series. But yet it gave you the impetus and the momentum to do so, right?
Absolutely. I was lucky because it's called The Wedding Plot, and it takes place at a destination wedding in Vermont, because in June, it's all about weddings in Vermont.
Okay.
And you'll appreciate this with your Milford Daffodil Festival, that it takes place on the weekend, which is really true. There's a weekend in late June every year where the wild orchids bloom, and they're very rare. They're called showy lady slippers, and they bloom at this one place in Vermont every year. So I set it that weekend so we'd have these lovely wild orchids. And because it's a wedding, I have all the families, right?
Uh-huh.
And so I was able to write the kernel into the story as a very charismatic and mysterious great uncle.
Cool. That sounds so much fun. So you've got setting, you've got a very special character, and you've got a time of the year that is, you know, is very unique to a small part of the country, something I did not know about. And you have the what ifs. You put it around a wedding. So what if this happens? And what if this happens? And if this happens? And if this happens? I'm not going to say that the pages wrote themselves, but I'm sure that it lifted you out of the funk that you were in and allowed you to meet your deadline.
Yes, it allowed me to move forward, and not just in the writing, but in the life itself, in life itself.
That is so cool. I'm happy to hear that.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. So you mentioned briefly through the course of this conversation, you kind of scattered it in there like nice spices to a soup, who you read now. But if there are other people that you read within our genre that you wanted to say that you really enjoy, this would be a good time to do so.
Okay. Well, I love Ann Cleaves.
Okay.
Who writes Vera and Shetland and Matthew Venn, I think, is her new, writes the Ruth Galloway series. I love, of course, Craig Johnson and Lee Child and Michael Connelly.
Okay.
And CJ Box.
Okay.
All those guys, I love them. I love Deborah Crombie, who writes police procedural set in London, even though she lives in Texas. She's great.
You know, that's interesting. You got somebody that lives in Texas writing London.
Yeah.
And I've just read Lisa Gray. I don't know if you know Lisa Gray, but she's with the Thomas and Mercer publishing group. And she is from Glasgow, Scotland, and has never visited greater LA, but yet she writes it as good as Connolly does. Or I even gave her a compliment that she like gushed over. I said, yeah, it's almost Chandler-esque the way you describe the area. So that's interesting that you have somebody from, I'm going to use the word Texas again, that writes London. I can't think of two more disparate places in my...
Exactly. But they're wonderful. Now, and she's on, I don't know, she's written at least a dozen books, probably more in her series. She's very successful and a lovely, lovely person. And I love London, and she really does capture it well. And there's also,
and you know, you write, you read her, you know, as every new book comes out, you give her a read, I guess is what you're
absolutely
saying.
Absolutely. I read all, I am very partial to series.
Yeah. And I have to tell you that too. And I've said this before on this podcast, and I'll say it again. I might pick up a novel list mid-series. And if I'm grabbed by the detective, I will stop right where I'm at, a couple pages in, you know, a couple chapters in, and say, nope, we're going to go back to the beginning. We're going to start from the beginning, and we're going to start all over again. And I did that with Lawrence Block with the Matt Scudder series.
Yes.
And I did it at a time when you could still get the books that had got into paperback from a paperback distributor before they went belly up. So I was able to order like 12 books, you know, in that series, and they all showed up. It was like Christmas came in, you know, July.
Absolutely. No, he's a fabulous writer. And of course he wrote the Bernie stories too.
Yeah. Bernie Rodenbaugh.
Yes.
The burglar, who stole my heart. The burglar who did this, that, the other thing.
He was great and very funny. And yet he could write the darker series as well. I also love Lisa Gardner, especially her new series.
What is it?
It's with Frankie Elkins.
Okay.
It's so good. It's already been picked up by Hilary Swank.
No kidding. Optioned for movies.
Yeah. Yeah. Very exciting. I love Lisa. She's a wonderful person and a wonderful writer.
Someday we're going to get that knock on the door, right? Say, hey.
Yeah.
Do you think Mercy, do you think we can get Mercy for a four season Netflix thing? Sure, Paula says. Yeah, absolutely. As long as Elvis can come along too.
The answer to is this a series or is this a film TV adaptation is almost always yes.
Yes. It is. That's funny. You're now four books into what was an experimental chapter. That is so cool. I love that. That's
the way life works sometimes, right?
Yeah. Paul, I wanted to ask you, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, you know, you can go to my website, paulamenier.com. I'm also part of careerauthors.com.
And what's that?
Career Authors is a wonderful website, she says. But it is. It's a wonderful website that we created. Thriller writers, Brian Andrews, who is part of the Andrews and Wilson franchise, wonderful writer. Dana Isaacson, who was a big shot editor at Penguin Random House and, you know, edited Michael Connelly and all the big names. He's kind of an editor's editor. Mm-hmm. And Hank Phillippe Ryan, who writes thrillers, very successful thrillers, USA Today bestselling author. Jessica Strasser, who now writes novels. She was the publisher of Writer's Digest for many years. So it's, and me. And so we just.
And me.
And me. And what we do is we just post articles and stories that we believe will be helpful to writers who want to make a career of writing. It's all free. You can just go there and check us out. And it's a lot of fun. Like next week, we're going to have Sarah Paretsky and all kinds of great writers and great articles on craft, on marketing, on all kinds of stuff that's free. You just go and check it out. So
send me a link because you have my email because that's how we've communicated.
Right.
And then I'll make sure that link gets put into the show notes. When we publish this, when this comes out. When we air this, I should say, not publish this, air this. This is great. Now, I didn't mean to jump away from the Paula Munier, and that's MUNIER.com. So it's paulamunier.com. But then the second one was, again, repeated for me because I just grabbed it from you so quick.
Career.
Yeah.
Authors, plural.
Yep.
Careerauthors.com. And of course, I'm on Facebook and Twitter and yada, yada, yada.
The usual places.
Yes.
So that's cool. I mean, that's a great little thing that you're doing there. It's your way of giving back.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
And the nicest thing about giving is that you receive so much in return. Try to monetize the thing and it flops. Just give it away, give away great content, and people are drawn to you like flies to honey. You know, yep. So it's fantastic. So I always ask this question because I come from a law enforcement and investigator background. So I'm not going to give you any trepidation here. But my question is there anything I failed to ask you right now that you think that my listeners should know about Paula and that we didn't cover because we just kind of flowed in this direction and that direction? There's a chance for you to bring something to the air now that you make sure that gets out there.
Well, I would always just say for any of you who want to be writers that it's never too late. I published my first mystery at 62, so it's never too late. And you should just go where your heart takes you. Write what you love. You know, they always say write what you know, but mm-hmm. I think it's write what you know, write what you love, and write what you'd love to know.
Okay. I'll add to that. I'll say that manuscript that's collecting dust in the drawer, pull it out, look at it, take what you can from it, you know, and if you can improve it or finish it, do so. If you can, but if you can take other things away from it after having it, let it sit for so long and let it marinate, but get back to it again and get started and make the time. Don't find the time, make the time. And start putting, you know, hands to keyboard, pen to paper, whatever, however you choose to do it. But get that story out because I will tell you, I am so glad that I did not ignore the siren's call to write my first book. Because if I had ignored that call, I probably would not be sitting here talking to you today, that's for sure. I wouldn't be 13 other books into my career, and I would never have had the opportunities that I've had. But what I would have is a heart full of regret saying, geez, I wish I would have done that. I wish I could have done that. So I think we're saying the same thing, but you from a inspirational, you can do it, it's never too late. Me from saying, you don't want to live a life of regrets. Don't regret not having written or tried to write, right?
So. Absolutely. I mean, I think one thing, if anything, the pandemic has showed us that, you know, now's the time for everything you mm-hmm. ever wanted to do.
Yeah. No, my writing actually increased a great deal during this time period because I wasn't commuting anywhere. I wasn't driving anywhere. I certainly wasn't in anywhere in public where, you know, I was in danger of catching a life-threatening disease. So it gave me a chance to sit there and stare at the keyboard and conjugate verbs.
There you go.
Definitely. So, Paula, thank you so much for this. I appreciate it. I'm glad that you came on the show today, and so are my listeners.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Thank you for listening. I hope that I've earned your interest and your time. Our guest next week is Ozma Khan. She is the author of The Unquiet Dead, published by St. Martin's Press Minotaur Books, and the winner of the Barry Award, the Arthur Ellis Award, and the Romantic Times Reviewer's Choice Award for Best First Novel, as well as a 2016 McCavity Award finalist. Works in Khan's critically acclaimed Essa Katek Rachel Getty mystery series include The Language of Secrets, A Death in Sarajevo, Among the Ruins, and The Dangerous Crossing. In A Deadly Divide, the fifth and latest book in the series, Detective Kotick and Getty investigate a mosque shooting in Quebec and explore the after effects of a rising tide of Islamophobia in both the province and the nation. Khan has been featured in Shondaland Profile of a Muslim Woman Authors Everyone Should Know and as Miss Chatterlane in Chatterlane's Magazine. Most recently, she was profiled on Public Radio International. The Blood Print, Ozma Khan's fantasy debut, has been hailed as one of the finest fantasy debuts. Published by Harper Voyager, US and UK, The Blood Print is book one of the Corasian Archives, a four-book epic fantasy series that is followed by The Black Khan in 2018, The Blue Eye in 2019, and 2019, Khan also was Siren's guest of honor. The Blade Bone, an epic conclusion of the Corasian Archives, was published in October of 2020. A frequent lecturer and commentator, Khan holds a PhD in international human rights law with research specialization in military intervention and war crimes in the Balkans from Osgoode Law School. She completed her LLB and LLM at the University of Ottawa and her BA in English Literature and Sociology at the University of Toronto. Formerly, she served as editor-in-chief of Muslim Girl magazine, the first magazine to address the target audience of young Muslim women. Muslim Girl reshaped the conversation about Muslim women in North America. The magazine was the subject of two documentaries and hundreds of national and international profiles and interviews, including CNN International, Current TV, and Al Jazeera, Every Woman. She's a longtime community activist and writer and currently lives in Colorado with her husband. Khan has a new crime series forthcoming with Minotaur Books, which features American Muslim detective Inaya Rahman. Inaya investigates homicides in minority communities in Colorado with her partner, Catalina Hernandez, and independent monitor, Arisha Adams, a trio of Muslim, Latino, and Black investigators who work to change a system impervious to reform from both the inside and the outside. The series debuted with Blackwater Falls this year. My pleasure to bring on Ozma to this podcast, and we had a great conversation. I think you'll enjoy it. This episode was brought to you by my own FBI agent, Marcia O'Shea, six-book series, and my upcoming Gwendolyn Strong Small Town Cozy Mystery series. To learn more, go to www.johnhoda.com, that's J-O-H-N-H-O-D-A.com, and join my email list. Liberty City Nights, my Marcia O'Shea prequel novella, is available to my subscribers there for free.